the reality is that we have a core group of people in law enforcement, that includes district attorneys, that are very wedded to the mass incarceration years, which, by the way, all the data shows that that created greater insecurity. But like anything else, you know, change is hard to come. And for some people, it will be very hard. Other people will adapt, and other people are embracing it very quickly.
L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon, speaking with KCRW's Greater L.A. last week, responding to pushback he has been facing in his own office over the criminal justice reforms he campaigned on. Well, yesterday, a judge blocked him from enforcing one of his major promises, ending the use of prison sentencing enhancements in thousands of criminal cases. The judge's order stemmed from a lawsuit brought late last year by the union that represents hundreds of L.A. County prosecutors. The union argued that Gascon's reforms required them to break state law. Yesterday's ruling is the latest development in mounting tensions between the new DA, who promised big changes to how his office prosecutes crimes, and his own deputy district attorneys. Here to talk about what's going on in the DA's office and what it means for Gascon's plans is James Quealy. He covers crime and policing for the LA Times. Hey there.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Great to have you back. Well, give us an overview of what the judge said.
Sure. So what happened yesterday, Judge Chalfant basically blocked a significant portion of DA Gascon's planned sentencing enhancement reforms as it has to do with active cases. For one of the major tenets of Gascon's platform was blocking prior strike enhancements, so serious or violent felony offenses that can add years to the sentence of a defendant's crime. Those have to, under the three strikes law, under state law, be charged by prosecutors. Gascon had sought to stop that practice. The injunction that the deputy DA's union won yesterday forces, or rather blocks Gascon from enacting that policy for all cases. It also severely handicaps how he had been ordering prosecutors to dismiss pretty much all sentencing enhancements. There is a narrow few that he is still allowing to go through, but you know, gang enhancements, enhancements for using a gun, causing great bodily injury during a crime, those sorts of things. He had been ordering deputy DAs to dismiss those in active cases, and the judge also found that that was pretty much forcing the deputy DAs to commit an ethical violation. So that policy also has to be rescinded momentarily. At least by the records I've got my hand on, there's a little bit shy of 11,000 defendants in LA County with active enhancement cases. So this impacts a pretty significant portion of the docket.
So it's not just the three strikes law, because as I understood it, the deputy DAs were arguing that by not following the enhancements based in that law, basically, like, you have to consider the prior felonies when sentencing in the third felony. By not following that, that's actually breaking state law. And so the judge said, well, you can't do that he said that to Gascon, right? You just can't break state law.
Easiest way to think about it is, you look at the three strikes as one situation, right? Pretty much the ruling is the deputy DA is under Gascon. They have to file enhancements for prior strikes, for any strike offense. That's in all cases. Separately, all the other enhancements that he wanted to bar the use of, those still have to be pursued in active cases. He is still allowed to stop them from filing enhancements in new cases that aren't related to strikes. So it's not a complete wipe away of what he was trying to do, but it hits a good number of sections of his special directives.
So what's his reaction to that? This is a major part of what he campaigned on, and now it's been wiped away.
So he didn't, wasn't chatty yesterday, mostly issued a statement. He's planning to appeal, which was, I think, probably going to happen no matter which way Judge Chalfant ruled. The DDA's union would have done the same. He's pointed out that he does think this is a bit of a disenfranchisement of the people who, of the voters who supported him. He did, win by about 7 or 8 percentage points, which is a not insignificant margin. He still firmly believes that enhancements are inherently racist, that they disproportionately impact communities of color. And, some members of his transition team have, done the research and put up data that he believes supports that position. He still thinks basically he's going to win on appeal, though. This is a fight. The fight is far from over kind of message from him.
Right. But what is the legal argument? How can he argue that it's okay to supersede the state law?
So the what you have seen happen in court for the most part when deputy DAs are trying to implement this directive he's put out, they are arguing that either the three strikes law is unconstitutional, but there's not really a secondary argument to that, or that the underlying sentencing triad for, say, someone's charged with assault, that the sentence for the underlying crime is in and of itself sufficient for public safety, and the enhancements are unnecessary. That's the statement he's had DDAs reading into court when they seek to dismiss these enhancements. I have, for the most part, when I have been in court and these hearings have happened, judges have blocked those motions to dismiss, because the only grounds you could seek to dismiss an active enhancement would be either, at least after the charges have been filed, would be either in the interest of justice or due to a change in the circumstances of the evidence. Basically you can't prove it anymore. And for the most part, that script that he has ordered the deputy DAs to read has not met either of those standards.
So the deputy DAs, they must be pretty happy with this decision.
Yeah, a lot of excited text messages I received yesterday. He is not. I think that some of the discussion around the DA's office lately is this idea that every deputy district attorney is, disagrees with Gascon's policies or against them. That's not the case, but it is a large portion of them. Certainly the union, a lot of the more veteran DAs who have been critical of what they see as Gascon's lack of legal experience. I've heard from a few people yesterday who strongly believe that this was indicative of that his lack of a courtroom background kind of led to this kind of what they see as like a legal error in him seeking to, ban the use of strike priors without, when the law is pretty clear that they have to be filed. So yeah, people are excited. But at the same time, things could change on appeal. So this is the first step in a longer fight, but yeah, certainly, certainly a lot of happiness among the DDA crowd.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the longer fight, it does seem like this is a nationwide wave to reimagine the DA's office to elect progressive prosecutors. What is going on in Sacramento in terms of legislation that would go to perhaps support Gascon's vision?
I don't know about legislation to support his vision necessarily, but there are, Rob Bonta last year introduced legislation that would bar police unions from contributing, or rather bar DAs from accepting police union contributions for future elections. As anyone who followed this race last November knows, the LAPPL, the ADDA, who was involved in this lawsuit, PORAC, some of the other big police unions poured millions of dollars into the race to try to beat Gascon. You will probably have seen that happen in places like San Francisco and Contra Costa, where you have progressive DAs, but we'll see that in the future. So that obviously, would tip the playing field in their favor. There's also been some discussion in some corners about possibly, putting a ballot measure up to modify three strikes. Nothing has been formally introduced, but that's obviously something your George Gascons and Chase of Badans of the world want to see. In general, the electorate obviously in California has shifted far more progressive now than it was in 1993 or 1994 when three strikes passed. So there is some consideration that the people in Sacramento, legislators, might be more likely to heed the advocacy of someone like Gascon or Boudin or some of the other progressives I mentioned versus the kind of older way of thinking is the way the progressives describe it, really the more traditional law and order minded DAs.
All right. Thank you, James.
Thanks for having me.
James Quealy, he covers crime and policing for the LA Times. Coming up, new immigration enforcement rules, a dramatic change under President Biden. We're going to explain that. And how residents in Big Sur are coping after a portion of Highway 1 was washed out. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Thousands of migrants have been showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border recently, hoping that President Biden's more lenient immigration agenda means they will get a chance to cross. The White House has plans to draft new rules for ICE in the coming days, directing them to not only to arrest only and deport immigrants who pose a national security or public safety risk, or who have served time for serious felonies, or who were caught crossing the border illegally. Already, some immigrant families have been released into the United States, and that's a big departure from what the Trump administration did. Here for an update on what's happening is Adolfo Flores. He reports on immigration for BuzzFeed News. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Describe what the border looks like now. What's the situation in the last few weeks since Joe Biden took office?
Well, there's been a lot of waiting and hoping that the new administration will start processing asylum seekers like the government did before Trump took office. And so there's just been a lot of confusion, especially in recent days, over what's happening and what's actually changed.
Right. And so the Trump administration had this remain in Mexico policy where people who wanted to seek asylum were told to wait in Mexico. What's happening with them?
Well, that's a group that I would say is the most frustrated. And just because if some of them have been waiting for a very long time, like, you know, 18 months, some close to 2 years. And so they've been asked to wait. You know, the Biden administration put out these new executive orders last week that didn't actually change anything. More than anything, it said, you know, we're going to look into undoing some of these policies, like the Remain in Mexico policy. And so there's about 24,000 people with open Remain in Mexico cases. A lot of them have gone home. A lot of them have come into the U.S. I mean, I say a lot, but it's hard to tell how many of those folks are still waiting at the border.
So meanwhile, inside the border, so people who are here who are undocumented, for many years, they were afraid of ICE raids. They were afraid some to go to the store or go pick up their kids from school, that they might be picked up. Do they no longer have to be afraid of that?
It looks like this week, ICE is going to put out, you know, new guidance for their agents. So yeah, like those, the people you just described would no longer be a focus, you know, for ICE officers. The new focus is people who are a national security threat, recent border crossers, and those who have been released from jail after being convicted of an aggravated felony. So it's a big departure from when Trump took office and he issued an executive order that basically made everyone who is undocumented a priority for deportation.
Right. And what about people who do cross the border illegally and they're caught by Border Patrol? What happens to them now?
That's what everyone's been trying to sort of figure out right now. So last week we heard that some families were being released into the U.S. In some parts of the border, which is, again, a big change from the last 4 years. But it was only in some areas, mostly along the Texas border, like in the Rio Grande Valley. But, you know, that created a lot of confusion because there's a lot of families waiting who want to cross. And so they, you know, places like El Paso, where the government is continuing to immediately expel or, you know, send immigrants back into Mexico, you know, they thought, oh, well, I can cross now and I'll be allowed to you know, fight my case from the U.S. But that wasn't the case across the border. This is only in some areas. So it was just a lot of confusion about where these changes have taken place and who it applies to.
So they were actually being sent back to Mexico, these recent border crossers?
Yeah, I mean, that's still happening. I mean, it's been happening since March. The Trump administration cited a CDC, a health rule that because of the pandemic, that said they could immediately expel. And I use expel because it's not a deportation, because they don't go through any of those processes. They're just sent back to Mexico, people from Central America. And you also had people like from Haiti who would be put on flights and expelled that way. And that is still happening.
That is still happening. No change in policy. And is it because of COVID?
No.
Or is that the stated reason?
No. Well, the initial reason for expelling people was because of COVID. But now in some parts of the border where their families are being allowed into the U.S., we're being told that it's because Mexico has begun enforcing a law it passed in November that prohibits holding children under 12 in government custody. So, that Mexico saying, well, we can no longer detain these families, so we will not, we won't take them. The U.S. has to, CBP, Border Patrol, you have to take these people. But, Border Patrol doesn't have a lot of space because of COVID as well. And so they're releasing them, with presumably court cases that they'll have to show up for eventually. But, for me, the reasoning doesn't always make sense. This thing with the Mexican law, in my experience, and, I didn't get to see every expulsions everywhere, or anywhere, actually. But, talking to advocates, the government of Mexico wasn't detaining these families everywhere. They would sometimes be given a document that gave them permission to be in Mexico, and sometimes they weren't. But I don't know that they were ever detaining them. So I don't know. The reasoning doesn't quite match up in all the cases.
Right. So it seems it's confusing at the border for everybody. What about for ICE agents? How are they coping with this? It seems like a pretty dramatic shift, especially when it comes to people who are already living here, who are undocumented. As you mentioned earlier, they're no longer going to be picked up for minor offenses. How is ICE reacting to this, or the people who work at ICE?
There were some reports about morale being low. I don't know if that's the case across the board for ICE agents. But the problem with having every undocumented immigrant be a priority is, ICE doesn't have the capacity to deport all those people. So, focusing it, I think, for some of them would be good, right? Because they don't have to, they can kind of pick and choose, okay, this is the person who's a priority, and then, this person is not, and I don't have to be stretched thin. I don't actually know what it is like across the board at ICE.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the update.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Adolfo Flores, National Security Correspondent for Immigration at BuzzFeed News. Well, further up the coast, Central California is still reeling from a torrential storm that slammed the region a few weeks ago. Heavy rain, nearly a foot of snow in the mountains, and, of course, mudslides. Probably the most striking visual from that storm was a collapsed section of Highway 1 along the Big Sur cliffside. It closed the only artery through one of the most isolated stretches of the California coast. Again, it's not quite as bad as a few years ago when it took more than a year to repair the highway and replace a key bridge. But part of the road will likely be closed for months. We're going to check in now with Kate Navoa. She's a retired attorney and longtime Big Sur resident, best known by her blog handle, Big Sur Kate. Welcome to Press Play, Kate.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, where do you live in relation to the problem with the highway, with the big hole in the highway? How is that affecting you?
Well, where my dirt road connects to Highway 1, that is 17 miles south of where the slip out happened.
Okay. And so what is on the other side of that slip out? that you would need to access?
Well, all of Big Sur proper, as we call it, that's the valley where everybody thinks of as being Big Sur, even though it's 72 miles long. So it cuts off all of that area to Big Sur, and it cuts off Monterey, other than having to go all the way around.
So Monterey is where you would go for what, like regular services, doctor's appointments, things like that?
Doctor's appointments are among them, yes, other kinds of services that we might have. We have access to the south, which is groceries, so that's not a problem. But other things like doctor's appointments are the big one.
So how do you get there now?
Now we have to go south on Highway 1 until we get to 46, which is south of Cambria, and then we go across that to Paso Robles. And then from Paso Robles, we go up 101 to 68, and then across to Monterey. It adds about 201 miles one way to our trip.
Wow. So hours.
Hours, yes. Instead of 2 hours to get to Monterey on a bad traffic day, it now takes us 5 hours.
Do you have to go there very often?
No, I don't have to go too often. And when I do go, I do like what I'm doing today, which is I came up yesterday, scheduled all my appointments within a 2 or 3 day window. We come up here and camp and then go home on Thursday.
And you've lived there for quite some time, right? For many, many years?
35 years, 36 next month.
Oh, my goodness. So you're probably used to natural disasters of this sort.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing with us. It's not a matter of if the road is going to close during the winter. It's a matter of when it's going to close, where it's going to close, and for how long it's going to close.
So how long are you hearing it's going to close this time?
Well, I heard a rumor, and Big Sur rumors are notorious. They may or may not be accurate, that they're going to try to do something temporarily. What that would be, I don't know, which could cut the time quite a bit. When we had the last slip out at Rocky Point, which was in 2011, I think it took them about 4 months to get that one fixed. And that was between Big Sur proper and Monterey, so it was much more critical to get it open. They were able to first have people create enough space for people to be able to walk from one side to the other, and then they were able to create enough space so that with traffic lights, they could go through one direction or another. I'm hoping they'll do something like that down here, and that would only be about 4 months instead of the year, whatever it took for the bridge in 2017.
Yeah, that took a long time. And obviously it had an effect on tourism. Are you worried about that? Are businesses worried that they're going to lose tourists?
The businesses north of the slide usually have a tendency to get most of their tourism from the north. So it's going to affect them. And they're predicting it will be down about 30%. But that's not as bad as it's been in the past. So they're okay. The businesses that are a problem are like Lucia, which can't get any business at all right now. They're north of where the highway is closed to the public, but south of the slide. So they're almost in their own little island, so to speak. They're the most affected of all of the businesses.
It is certainly one of the most beautiful spots in America, if not on Earth, that section of the coastline.
I agree.
But I don't know if you read that article by Jane Smiley. It was an essay in the LA Times over the weekend where she lives in the area, and she was wondering, do humans really need to access every place on Earth? Like, is nature sending you a message that maybe Big Sur shouldn't be occupied, that it just should be wild?
Well, I did read her article, and in fact, I quoted one paragraph and then referred back to her from my blog yesterday, as a matter of fact. So, and I'm getting quite a lot of feedback myself about that question. The problem with Big Sur is that had we not actually occupied it, the residents that live there, we have one of the most restrictive building codes and land use plans in the nation here. It would not be the Big Sur that everybody's come to enjoy now. It limited the amount of commercial property that was available. It limits the number of houses that can be built. It's very restrictive. And from that perspective, having people live here has been a good thing, because who knows what it would be like otherwise. But I appreciated her article and I agree with parts of it, but I'm not sure that it's possible to not have Big Sur accessible to the world.
Hmm. Well, certainly many of us who have traveled up and down Highway 1 would have missed out on the experience had there not been that highway. We would not know anything about Big Sur personally.
Right. And people become, if they come to Big Sur and they actually spend time instead of just driving through on the highway, then there becomes a bigger and more deep appreciation of nature and the beauty that can be if we don't interfere, or we minimize our interference, I should say.
Right. But there's the conundrum right there.
That's right.
Our very presence is, in fact, interfering with nature.
It does. But we are also part of nature.
Well, best of luck to you as you endure another example of nature's power. Kate Novoa, Central California coastal resident. She blogs as Big Sur Kate. Kate, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a small West Virginia newspaper has sued Facebook and Google, claiming their advertising model is starving journalism. Plus, the Cecil Hotel in downtown LA, object of fascination for true crime enthusiasts.
You know, it became almost like an adult amusement park, you know, with a circus.
That's all coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Think about the last time you read a news article online. You almost certainly saw some ads off to the side, maybe for something you recently thought about buying. And if you were to look really closely at those ads, you'd probably see the phrase powered by Google somewhere in tiny font. Maybe you didn't think much about it, but newspapers sure have. Google's dominance in online advertising has been the source of major problems for the industry, which used to rely on ad dollars to survive. Now, a local company, a newspaper company in West Virginia called HD Media, is suing both Google and Facebook, accusing them of monopolizing digital advertising and driving newspapers out of business. Here to talk about this is Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, how did we get to this point where newspapers that aren't owned by wealthy individuals such as yours rely so much on Google for their advertising revenue?
So, I mean, this has been a long story in the history of local newspapers that used to be very vibrant and very healthy financially because they had so many print advertisements. But, you know, that has changed radically as the internet has changed the world. And as these newspapers have tried to, you know, as their readers have gone over to digital devices and reading digitally, they've wanted to, you know, get the revenue from digital advertising as well as from digital subscriptions. But what's happened is that more than half of all digital ads are sort of siphoned off by Facebook and Google together. Mm. If you put the two of them together, they are monopolizing can be a legal word, and I'm not ready to make that judgment, but they're certainly taking up a lot of the oxygen in the digital ad space.
And then they give a portion of that money to the newspapers, but not enough.
Yeah, I mean it's a sort of a complicated formula and not all the same across all media or anything like that. But what it means is that newspapers cannot very effectively, you know, newspapers can be in chains or they can be privately held, but they're basically small compared to the huge behemoths of Facebook and Google. And so really this is about, can you compete fairly?
And so what is this newspaper company, HD Media in West Virginia, saying?
So, you know, interestingly, they own one of the papers they own is the Charleston Gazette Mail, which won a Pulitzer Prize for its opioid coverage in 2017, but has really suffered from the lack of revenue. And so that company actually, the newspaper actually went bankrupt the year after it won the Pulitzer. So, you know, very dramatic sort of ups and downs there. Then they were bought at auction by this chain, small chain, HD Media. And HD Media is saying in its lawsuit against Google and Facebook, this isn't fair. This is not a fair playing field. It's an antitrust lawsuit. So that has to do with an illegal monopoly. That's the charge here. And the charge is also that Facebook and Google have kind of, again, this is not a legal term, but have worked together illegally or conspired to fix the prices in certain cases of digital advertising. And so the, you know, idea behind this suit is this isn't fair. We can't compete properly, and it's driving us out of business. And of course, this is a story that's being repeated throughout the whole country, but we've never seen a lawsuit about it.
Right. Well, I guess initially it sounded like a good deal, right? So Google would say to you, let's say newspaper, hey, we're going to get all this advertising for you and we'll share in the proceeds, in the revenues. And the newspapers said, okay, I guess we'll let you do that. Why didn't the newspapers come up with their own advertising model?
I mean, you know, Google and Facebook are very, very good at what they do. They're very good at targeting. They're very good at distribution. You know, they are expert at it. And this is part of the reason that they have grown to be so many people feel like they're really out of control in their size. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to what's happening in this little newspaper suit, there are lawsuits, there are antitrust lawsuits against Google and Facebook happening in different realms all over the country brought by state attorney generals. And, you know, this is just one piece of our sort of recognition as a society that these companies are huge, they dominate, and they need to be brought to heel. So, but, you know, if you want to look at it in a purely local media way, we are suffering. I wrote a book last year called Ghosting the News about the demise of local newspapers. And I spent much of my career as the editor of one of these papers. And they're really, really hurting. And it's hurting our democracy badly to lose the reporting and the local coverage that is going away.
Right. I mean, 2,000 or so local papers gone in the last, 10, 15 years?
15 years. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since COVID has happened, that has dried up so much of the remaining print advertising that that trend has actually accelerated. So, you know, half of all newsroom staffs in newsrooms are gone. You know, 2,000 papers have closed their doors and more. Yeah. It's happening more and more. So, I mean, one question that I have about this suit is, well, even if it's successful, and who knows whether it'll even proceed, but even if it's successful, you can't actually undo the past. And I don't know if an industry that a lot of people think is on its deathbed can actually be brought back to life. And that's a shame.
It is. It's more than a shame. It's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, a grisly death at the Cecil Hotel became an object of fascination worldwide. That story and the history of the hotel is told in a new documentary. We'll have that for you next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The old Cecil Hotel in downtown L.A. has a reputation for being one of the most haunted places in the city, maybe even the country, and maybe even for good reason. Built in the 1920s, the hotel used to provide cheap rooms for international travelers and people living on Skid Row. Over the years, it earned the nickname Hotel Death.
For some reason, that hotel had some extra bit of insanity going on within those walls. Drug dealers, prostitutes, rapists, murderers,
Well, Cecil was a place where serial killers, you know, let their hair down.
Serial killers like the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, who would come back there to sleep after killing people in the 1980s. More recently, one horrific death there captured the world's attention and baffled investigators, the 2013 death of Elisa Lam.
The Elisa Lam case was extremely unusual, and it raised all different types of questions. How did she end up here? In a water tank on the roof of the Cecil Hotel. Do we have a crime here? What actually happened?
A new Netflix docuseries takes us inside the Cecil Hotel. It retraces Lam's final moments with interviews with the hotel staff who were there that night, with investigators who looked into the case, and with the cyber sleuths who tried to solve it. The series is called Crime Scene: The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. And joining me is the executive producer of the series and director, Joe Berlinger. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Madeline, nice to see you again or hear from you again.
Yeah, you too. And former manager of the Cecil Hotel, Amy Price. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, Joe, let's begin with you. What intrigued you about this story, Elisa Lam's disappearance?
A journalist named Josh Dean, who wrote extensively about the case and the locale of the Cecil, came to me and suggested that, you know, there might be an interesting docuseries here. And I agreed, but I wanted to do it in a slightly different way, which is we're launching a series now that talks about the location of crimes as opposed to leaning into specific and individual crimes. So what is it about the Cecil Hotel? You know, what are the socioeconomic and perceptual forces that kind of create a place where crimes seem to repeatedly happen? But this case is just utterly fascinating because it's all about perception. These web sleuths really leaned into investigating the case, and that that in and of itself is a fascinating idea. They were so taken by the disappearance of Elisa Lam that they wanted to try to solve it, and they went down various rabbit holes, and it just kind of fed upon itself.
And Amy, when you started working in the Cecil in the, around 2007? Did you know anything about its reputation?
No, I actually got this job through a friend, and it was just a conversation initially about, you know, a friend's husband that needed some help at a hotel he just started working at downtown. And I had the time and I just said yes.
Right. And so when did you realize what the Cecil was and what had gone on there?
I mean, it wasn't long before I first started working there that, you know, somebody passed away. And I do remember asking, you know, does this happen often? And, you know, the person that I was, you know, talking to said, well, yeah, it does happen, you know, a lot. And, you know, I was surprised, you know, I had never experienced anything like that.
To put it into context, the Cecil Hotel was one part regular hotel and one part residential hotel, right? And so it was for people who lived in the area, maybe, you know, people who weren't, you know, so desperate that they were living on the streets in Skid Row, but not too far above that on the economic run, living at the Cecil Hotel. And so a lot of people in dire straits.
You know, the Cecil Hotel was, you know, just a step above Skid Row, to be honest with you.
And for young travelers, though, it was also seen as a place, a cheap place to stay. And they would come there thinking that they were staying at kind of like a youth hostel, right?
So the initial plan was, you know, to transform the hotel into something totally different, you know, it being half hotel, you know, half residential. We were, you know, challenged as, you know, to bring in some extra money. We designed a hotel, you know, that were, it was three floors within the hotel. And that's where Stay on Main came in the picture. And we started marketing to the younger travelers.
Joe, Elisa Lam didn't know anything about the Cecil either. Why did she stay there?
Well, as Amy just indicated, they had did a nice job of marketing this hostel, this hotel within a hotel. Called Stay on Main. You know, if you Googled for a hotel, you would find a very inexpensive, nice looking hotel. You know, we can all imagine ourselves taking that kind of first trip as a, you know, young 21-year-old woman deciding to, you know, take that West Coast tour. I don't think she knew what she was, you know, what kind of place she was stepping into.
Right. So here's a young woman from British Columbia on her first trip on her own. Her parents are pretty protective. They ask her to check in with them every day. They're a little fearful. And then she stops communicating with them. And then the mystery unfolds. And lots of detectives were on this case, right? Like 20 detectives, Joe?
Yeah, initially, it was a missing persons case. It involved a foreign national, and LAPD, really sent a bunch of people out to investigate. That force ended up being reduced to about 4 detectives because of another case started swirling. But initially, they put a lot of resources into it.
And Amy, what was that like for you as the manager of the hotel? You were the manager at the time.
It was very gradual how it all unfolded. I mean, in the beginning, we were, looking for a missing person. But from the beginning to the end, we were equally as, cooperative, and we worked directly with the police force, anything that they needed. I mean, they were on site for weeks. We gave them a room of their own to go through all the footage. I mean, everything that you do see, as far as the elevator footage, I mean, all that was provided from us.
And the elevator footage is key, and that's what gets the amateur sleuths interested in this. Can you describe what that is, Joe?
The LAPD were stumped after some days, and they decided to release this elevator footage in order to get assistance from the public. They had footage of her in the elevator. So the last known footage of Elisa was in this hotel elevator, where it was stuck on a floor, and she was acting kind of strangely, walking in and into the hallway, walking back into the elevator, gesticulating strangely. And it just was quite captivating and bizarre. It just went viral. People thought, because of the history of the hotel, that somehow something sinister and evil had happened to her.
Right. And they thought maybe it was ghosts involved, or some of them did, or that there was her killer was just outside the frame, outside the elevator door, is keeping the door open, those kinds of things.
Right, all sorts of theories as to what had befallen her. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to look into the case, because a terrible tragedy happened, and it's kind of been written off as just a ghost story. And I felt it was important in the show to kind of bring her to life with her writings on Tumblr, and to take the audience on this journey that all of these cyber sleuths, they kept coming up with clues and theories. And a lot of these theories relied on the paranormal and the supernatural. And I think the show demonstrates that actually something quite different took place.
And Amy, you had some interaction with her. What was the nature of those interactions? What was she like?
I had very indirect interaction with her. I mean, I was the general manager, so of course I oversaw all the hotel operations. The two groups that had the most interaction with her would have been, the front desk and the housekeeping department. So she was sharing a bunk room and, with other females. And I guess she wasn't following the rules, I should say, as if you're sharing, a room with other guests. And so we decided to relocate her so she could have a room on her own.
Mm-hmm. Then you get a call from some hotel guests, I should say, that there's something wrong with the water. The water pressure is low. And you send a maintenance man to investigate. And then he discovers what has happened to her. I don't think I'm ruining the story, because it was a huge news story here. But she was discovered dead in the water tank on the roof of the hotel. What was your reaction to that, Amy?
It was shocking. But I'll just tell you, it suddenly turned into a mob scene. There were so many things to do. It's hard to even relive the day. It was so involved.
Yeah. And certainly nothing you had thought you would have had to encounter or that you signed up for. Joe, what happened after that? Because that seems to really have brought out all of the people who are interested in this around the world to try to solve the crime.
I mean, really, it was the viral video that brought all the attention. I think when her body was actually discovered, then the conspiracy theories really started taking off, and people felt something terrible had happened to her. And there's one particular character in the show who was cyber bullied because they were convinced that he was the murderer. Part of the problem is that the autopsy report took a long time to come out. And during that period, all sorts of conspiracy theories started circulating, and people really wanted to try to solve her case.
Right. And so, Amy, then people come and they try to see what happened firsthand and try to figure out how she got up to the roof and the water tank. So did you have people all over your hotel from all over the world just trying to do that? And how disruptive was that?
Oh, it was extremely disruptive. I mean, from the moment that, you know, she was discovered and, you know, just, of course, the circumstances of her death, you know, it became almost like an adult amusement park, you know, it was a circus. I mean, people trying to access the building from the exterior, you know, coming in with cameras, you know, I mean, it was crazy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Cecil Hotel deserved its reputation, or do you think it got a bad rep? Or, I mean, you worked there for 10 years.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I think that people like to cling to the past, and I'm not talking about Elisa here. I'm talking about, you know, from the moment that happened, it was almost like Richard Ramirez had just checked out the day before, you know, and last time I checked, he was picked up in 1985, you know, so they were clinging to some of the stories that had happened way before my time.
Yeah. But still, Joe, that is why you are interested in the Cecil Hotel, right? That this is a place where people cling to these stories.
Yeah, I kind of wanted it to, you know, take the true crime genre and turn it on its head a little bit, because past tellings of the story have really leaned into the paranormal and supernatural. And I kind of wanted to unpack it. And obviously, we're all very concerned these days about how we live in sort of a post-truth world where whoever presents the best narrative seems to be telling the truth. And it has been mind-boggling to me in this particular case that a lot of these coincidences or a lot of the circumstantial factors that led people to believe that this was a murder, you know, even when those factors have been disproved, people still cling to this ghost story, you know, and true crime's a funny thing. When you do a true crime project, you always have to remember for the victim of a situation, whether it's a crime or an accident, it's not just another story on television. This is the worst moment of their lives. And so there's an onus upon the makers of true crime, including myself, to tell these stories responsibly and to write off the tragedy of Elisa Lam as, you know, a ghost story or some supernatural event, I think is being disrespectful to the victim.
Yeah. And the truth being that she had mental illness and she was perhaps having a psychotic episode and climbed into this water tank, and, you know, there she drowned.
Tragic.
It's a tragic story, and one that tragically does fit in with the neighborhood where there are lots of mentally ill people living on the streets on Skid Row.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I wanted to do with the show, is to study the location and not just the quote unquote crime. And Los Angeles has had some terrible policies of how they have dealt with the burgeoning Skid Row in that area, the policy of containment, the policy of dropping homeless people into that area and hoping to keep them there, dropping mentally ill people into that area. All of those factors have contributed to the perception of, you know, the Cecil being a sinister place. But in fact, you know, the hotel, you know, has good bones to it, as Amy says in the show. And it's the neighborhood that I think has contributed to the perception of crime.
Yeah. And what is the status of the Cecil Hotel now?
Well, there's still some tenants living, long-term tenants living there, but as a hotel, it's no longer functioning as a hotel. But I do believe there's a new owner who has plans to renovate. And as downtown gets renovated, they have big plans for the hotel.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That's Amy Price and Joe Berlinger talking about Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, which debuts tomorrow on Netflix. And that'll do it for us here on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.